This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, turning to Latin America, countdown to peace in Colombia, but economic and social chaos in Venezuela. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. It's a tale of two countries. In June, the Colombian government and the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, signed a historic bilateral ceasefire and disarmament accord, marking an end to an internal conflict which has claimed some 220,000 lives, displaced upwards of 6 million, and caused untold suffering and economic damage. The document laid out the specific mechanisms for the concentration and disarmament of the FARC's 6 to 7,000 fighters and included new security provisions to protect demobilized fighters and civil society activists in the post-war era. A final peace deal to end Latin America's longest-running conflict is still many weeks off, but analysts say the ceasefire agreement marks a significant step forward. A peace deal reached would be put to Colombians for approval in a referendum. Meanwhile, in neighboring Venezuela, the news is grim. The collapse of oil revenues has had a severe impact on the economy. There are crippling shortages of food, which have prompted President Nicolas Maduro to put the armed forces in charge of a new food supply system. Many analysts say that political and economic mismanagement are at the heart of the food shortages and militarization of the economy. Generals already run state companies importing the bulk of Venezuela's food, as well as the largest bank, a television station, and a state mining company. Well, with us to discuss the historic bilateral ceasefire and disarmament accord between the Colombian government and the FARC and the causes and implications of Venezuela's socioeconomic crisis are two distinguished regional analysts. Eric Farnsworth is vice president of the Council of the Americas and the America Society. And that's a Washington-based organization widely considered to be a leading voice on the Western Hemisphere. And Eric Olson, he's associate director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, a think tank based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Well, first to you, Eric Farnsworth. Let's talk about the significance of the peace deal between the Colombian government and the FARC, ending five decades of insurgency.
This is a game changer. I don't think the importance of this can really be overstated, either for Colombia or for the region at large. This is the last remaining hot war, if you want to put it that way, in the Western Hemisphere. It's been going on, as you said, for some 50 years. Hundreds of thousands of people who have been killed, many of them civilians, up to 80% the estimates are, non-combatants. But we also have to remember, even the people who haven't been killed have been displaced. Colombia has the second highest population of displaced persons in the world after only Syria. So by bringing this really divisive, horrible situation to a close, what you have the opportunity to do is bind up your wounds and begin the reconstruction process, which will take years to do, but it gives you that opportunity. It's a game changer for Colombia.
Eric Olson, a game changer for Colombia?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we all see Colombia as one of the great countries of Latin America with very highly skilled and educated people with great economic potential, a democracy, but they've been weighted down for the last 50 years by this internal armed struggle. And it's really remarkable that they've been able, under the current administration, to bring the FARC to the table, to sit down and negotiate point by point. This is something that's been attempted before with other guerrilla groups, with the FARC even 10 years ago. This is the first time we've seen success. It's a great moment of optimism for the future of Colombia. A lot of challenges ahead, as Erica said, but definitely a positive.
Before we get into those challenges, Eric Farnsworth, talk about the primary factors that led to this day, because Eric Olson alluded to the fact that it's been tried before but didn't succeed. So what made this succeed?
Well, I think there's a sense of exhaustion in the field by the guerrillas. They had been losing in the battlefield. The current government and the previous government had really put the pressure on them from the military side. And you had an aging leadership in the guerrillas who, frankly, see this as their best chance to get out from the jungle and to enter into politics and to join the national conversation in a way that's not shooting and killing people. At the same time, I think the Colombian people were and are exhausted by conflict. And one of the reasons why President Santos, you could argue, was elected was because he promised to focus on a couple things. One was bringing peace to the country. The second was economic development and to put this chapter behind people so that they could focus on the future and not the past. And so you had that. I think the other element, and Eric Olson alluded to this, is leadership. But President Santos has clearly made this his top priority, and he's focused on it. His government is focused on it, and they've made this really something that they see as a legacy issue and really want to conclude before the term ends.
Eric Olson, please feel free to add or subtract to anything that Eric Farnsworth just said, but talk about the difference between the leadership. Why is it that President Juan Manuel Santos's predecessor, Alvaro Uribe, was against this accord?
I think that's a really interesting point. One of the challenges that's, you know, still before Colombia, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, there will be a plebiscite. The people of Colombia will have a say, a final say in whether they accept or not the final peace deal. And former President Alvaro Uribe announced that he was going to oppose the plebiscite. So there's a good bit of conflict still within civilian politicians. But yes, they have different perspectives on this. President Santos has been committed to bringing this conflict to an end in a dignified and negotiated way. I think President Uribe was committed to defeating the FARC militarily, and he felt that not enough had been done that way. And he fears, quite frankly, that many FARC atrocities may go unpunished. I don't necessarily personally believe that's the case, but that's his argument that the FARC is going to benefit here. They're going to be elected to Congress. They'll be, you know, legitimized in some way. Frankly, this is a longstanding conflict, and really the only way to do this is to bring them into the public process, into the elections, help them become a real political party that will either stand and win or lose at the polls instead of at the end of a machine gun, and that's positive.
Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Briefly, let's step back for a moment and examine the historical context that gave rise to the FARC. This is a 5-decades-long insurgency. Remind us why they came to be.
Well, this arises out of circumstances that are both specific to Colombia and also broader regional circumstances. It was a different time. It was a different place where the legitimacy of armed conflict for regime change was widely accepted, at least by certain segments of the ideological spectrum, and supported by various governments, both in the region and outside the region. But I think you do have a certain sense across the region at this point that armed conflict really is not the legitimate way into politics at this point. I mean, you still have some holdouts, and frankly, that's going to be one of the challenges of implementation, because you can do the deal with the FARC leadership, for example, but the question of whether the FARC will be able to control all of their commanders in the field and will there be break-off groups that will try to continue the fight, I think that's a very active conversation right now in Colombia. But the idea of using violence for regime change, I think that's become delegitimized across Latin America. I think that's a good thing.
Well, back to you, Eric Olson. In fact, what Eric Farnsworth says is certainly correct. That was the Cold War days. But to the question of holdouts, are there outliers who pledge allegiance to the FARC who might derail the deal in your view? How much of an impediment is that in your view?
Well, derail the deal at this point, I think, is unlikely. I do think the majority of the FARC leadership will go along and the majority of people want a way out. Yes, there are elements. One of their military fronts has already announced that it won't demobilize. This is always the case when there's a process of demobilization of armed groups anywhere in the world, so it's not unique to Colombia. The other complicating factor here is that there is an element here that involves not an ideological struggle, but the whole issue of drug production, organized crime, and so on. So while what Eric Farnsworth said is absolutely true, I agree, we've moved beyond armed conflict to solve ideological struggles in Latin America. There's still obviously an enormous number of people who are vested in the drug trade, and so they won't disarm no matter what the deal is because they benefit too much from cocaine, quite frankly. Now, we saw that same phenomenon in the context of the other armed group in Colombia that was disarmed during the Uribe years, the paramilitary or militia forces, they disarmed as well, but a good portion of them really just evolved into what are called the BACRIM, the criminal bands that continue in the drug trade. So that's the long-term challenge for Colombia, but there's no question it's a positive step to get this out of the ideological, bring a lot of these people into the political process of elections. That's definitely a positive step forward.
Well, back to you, Eric Farnsworth. Let's talk about the obstacles to a final peace deal, because what we're talking about is a disarmament accord at this point. So between now and the peace deal, what are the major obstacles you see, challenges?
There are some details that have to be worked out about collection of weapons and collection of combatants into special zones and monitoring and verification. But the United Nations has agreed to be actively monitoring the accords once they're finally implemented and is ready with its personnel to come to Colombia within 2 weeks of when the accords have been fully agreed. So I think there's a very active process of monitoring and verification. But, you know, some of the issues go well beyond just the demobilization of combatants. Eric Olson referred to one, which is absolutely right. But another obstacle is, remember what I said in terms of the displaced persons. A lot of these folks have been forced off their land, whether it's by guerrillas, whether it's by the paramilitaries, whether it's by some other faction or group in Colombia. They want their land back. And they, frankly, have a right to their land. The president of Colombia has said there's a process in place to try to resolve these claims. But that is a complicated process because in the interim time, you may have had other folks who have purchased the land legally and according to what they thought was perfectly legitimate means. And now they have title to it, but they purchased it from somebody who may have stolen the land in the first place. So who has real title to it? So this has implications that go well beyond just collecting weapons and stopping fighting. That's the condition precedent, and it's a very important one, and it's one that's eluded negotiators for 50 years. But having said that, that's the first step. And as we go forward, we're going to see where all of these other difficulties will arise and how the government will be able or not to address them.
Eric Olson, do you know if there is a plan, especially for the economy, to get it back on course in the rural areas that were previously occupied or will be soon unoccupied by the FARC rebels and occupied by civilians and the legitimate security forces, in terms of converting a narco-trafficking economy to a more sustainable, legitimate one?
Precisely. There are very specific plans in that regard. They've identified strategic areas where there will be specific investment. As you suggest, the strategy here is to provide people with an economic alternative to growing coca leaf. And so that requires investment in agriculture and requires investment in roads and marketing, all those kinds of things, investment in mid-sized cities so people can get employment. We know what the problem is. There are plans. There's money committed. It's just incumbent upon the international community and the Colombian people and government to really focus and make sure that happens, because people will become disillusioned. What you don't want is people to say, hey, I had it better when I was carrying a machine gun and at least I had three squares and people were taking care of me. That's the risk here. So I think we have to make sure that we follow through on these kinds of plans.
Quickly before we go to a break, Eric Farnsworth, I understand there is a mechanism to hold accountable those accused of serious human rights crimes so that they're not reabsorbed.
This has been one of the most difficult aspects of the negotiation, and frankly what has caused some of the opposition to arise within Colombia for the accords, which is to say the challenge of, first of all, identifying who's responsible for human rights abuses versus common criminal activities, and then what do you do with those people? There is an agreement in place, and the question will be for the Colombian people, will they accept it? But one additional quick point in terms of what Eric Olson was just talking about as well, though. This peace agreement hasn't been negotiated in a vacuum. In other words, it's built on the experiences of previous peace negotiations, both in Latin America and, frankly, around the world, South Africa, other places. And so some of the challenges that will face the Colombian people in implementation will not be unexpected. And because of that, the negotiators from both sides have built in protections to try to address some of those issues so that we don't have a reprise of what happened in some ways from the Central America peace processes or from some of the other processes around the region, where you actually have the agreement once it's in place, once it's fully implemented, go forward. You don't have the backtrack and you don't have that cynicism sneak in that we've seen so far in other places around the world.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Eric Farnsworth, from whom you just heard. He's vice president of the Council of the Americas and the Americas Society. And Eric Olson, he's associate director of the Latin American program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We're discussing the significance of the recent FARC ceasefire agreement, and soon we'll be discussing the deteriorating political and socioeconomic situation in Venezuela. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. As always, we love to hear from you. Here's a shout out to Abdullah Ali from Kenya. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or leave us a comment and like us on our Facebook page. Well, starting with you this time, Eric Olson, let's talk about Venezuela. Oh, revenues have been down now for many years. It was a wealthy country before. Now we're seeing enormous food shortages, people lining for hours and hours, if not more. Talk about how we got to this situation.
Yeah, it's really a mystifying situation. And I have to confess, I actually grew up in Venezuela. I moved there when I was 3, lived there until I went to the university. And those were the golden years. Venezuela's currency rate was one of the most stable in the world. People had jobs, there was investment, all those sorts of things. I think to simplify a very complex situation, you know, there was a revolution of sorts with the Chavez people coming in. And they built an economy that was solely dependent on oil revenue, which more or less worked when the price of oil was well over $100 a barrel and the government could distribute things the way they wanted. But it really was an economy built on oil revenue, built on government control, really in many regards anti-market. And so the chickens are coming home to roost now. Production of food domestically fell tremendously. Now that's not a problem if you can afford to import things, but they can't any longer. And there just isn't industry the way there was. Manufacturing is way down. And so they're highly dependent on imports. The government has tried to control currency rates. So inflation now is, I believe, up to almost 200%. There are food shortages, lack of production, unemployment. And so the situation has just ground down to really a crisis point for Venezuela and Venezuelans.
Eric Farnsworth, how do you see the situation in Venezuela? Chickens are coming home to roost now, says your colleague here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think when the textbook is written about how to destroy a modern economy, I think Venezuela will be the perfect example. And the Chavista revolution has done exactly that. It's destroyed a very modern economy, at least in the Latin American context. The price of oil is down, and that's a dramatic factor, particularly when 95% of your exports are energy-related, specifically oil. But there are other, I mean, every oil-exporting country in the world is hit by the same issue, but they're not in economic crisis. And so it's not just the price of oil, it's the gross mismanagement of the entire oil sector. People have been put in jobs for ideological purposes, not because they're competent. The state energy company, PDVSA, has really become a jobs program and a social development program, not an energy company anymore. And so what you're seeing is production is going down. So it's not just the price is going down, but the amount of oil that's being pumped is going down because of mismanagement, lack of investment, lack of maintenance in a very capital-intensive industry. At the same time, a lot of that output is already spoken for, so it can't be sold on the open market. It's either given away to Cuba or countries in Central America and the Caribbean at very, very low concessionary rates, or it's already been pre-purchased by China. And so the benefits have been received up front and frankly squandered, but you still have the obligation of delivering those oil deliveries to China. And as the price of oil goes down, you have to actually increase the amount that's delivered to meet the same amount from a financial perspective. And so you have an entire sector that's breaking down. At the same time, Eric was referencing the attack on the broader private sector. That's absolutely true. The private sector can't get access to hard currency. If you can't do that, you can't import anything. If you can't import anything, you can't produce. The consumer is looking to have. So industry is shutting down, people are moving out, and the final element I think that we have to say is one of law enforcement, not just street crime, which is exploding, but the whole idea of corruption. I mean, the economy has been thoroughly corrupted by the folks at the top who are living very well, enriching themselves, have private accounts and access to concessionary financing through different exchange rates and various sweetheart deals that the common Venezuelans don't have. But they have simply been taking billions of dollars out of the Venezuelan economy that should be used otherwise for productive purposes. And the question is, where is it going politically?
Well, exactly. So that's the question to you, Eric Olson. Where is this going politically? How do you assess the political opposition? Do they have strength? There's talk of a presidential recall. What's the status of that?
Well, there's a process in the Constitution for a recall referendum, but the hoops, if you will, that people need to jump through are quite complex, and the authorities that oversee the election, the CNE, has been nothing but obstructionist. The opposition has its own internal divisions, but, you know, the president, President Maduro, and his party have become so unpopular, with approval ratings below 30% at different times, that the opposition has been able to come together and really push forward on trying to meet some of these different benchmarks to hold the plebiscite or referendum to recall. It's still unclear is if they're going to be able to accomplish it because they get such short periods of time where they have to collect immense numbers of signatures. They met the first hurdle, but now they have another hurdle where they have to collect 1% of the registered voters who want to recall the president. And it's not just 1% nationally, but each voting district. So they have to have enormous ability to organize across the country, even in the most remote areas. So there are a lot of bureaucratic obstacles to that. And if they don't hold the referendum before the 17th of January, the law says that the president simply steps down and turns it over to his vice president. And of course, that would be essentially continuity of the current government, something that the opposition wants to avoid. So they're rushing as much as they can to do this before the 17th. I think we all generally believe that if there was a referendum, if people actually could express their opinion in a legitimate way, there'd be no question that there would be a recall at this point.
So if there is a recall, Eric Farnsworth, what happens to Maduro, and is the country prepared for a transition in a more positive direction?
One of the successes, if you want to call it that, of the Maduro administration has been, first of all, to try to delegitimize the opposition, but also to put in jail the natural leaders of the opposition. So whether it's Leopoldo López or Antonio Ledezma or others, folks who would naturally be leading candidates to be perhaps president at some point, they're in jail as political prisoners. And so the natural leader of the opposition, it's unclear at this point. There are several who probably could fill that role. But in answer to your question, is the country ready for transition? It's probably not. And I think that's one of the things that the current government is trying to make sure of. It's also trying to just delay, because as Eric referenced, if the referendum isn't held before a certain time, well, then the government remains in power. So the time is not on the side of the opposition. So if you're already divided and you know you have to organize across the entire country and your natural leaders aren't able to help you out because they're in jail, you face a pretty uphill climb, and it is going to take the push of the international community to really set a date and hold this referendum and to make sure that it's free and fair, and then coming out of that to see what the next steps would be in terms of the popular will of Venezuela.
Indeed, and let's end on that. So to you, Eric Olson, what are the prospects of the international community getting involved? Because it doesn't seem like the Venezuelans, whether the government or the people, the opposition, are able to affect change. So that is the United Nations, the OAS, the Europeans.
Well, there have been some regional bodies, the OAS being one. There are other regional bodies, sub-regional bodies in the Southern Cone that have tried at different points to play a mediation role. But no one yet has been able to bring together the region as a whole. That's the lacking element in the international community. The U.S. can do some things, but really it's going to require the Latin Americans themselves. Brazil has to play a clear role. Argentina, Mexico. There's talk about it. There's a willingness. There seems to be movement in that direction, but nothing has really coalesced entirely at this point.
And the last word to you, Eric Farnsworth. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but What do you think the prospects of resolving this situation?
Well, I think the situation goes from bad to worse. I would like to think that if there is a referendum, and I hope that there is, it will be done freely and fairly, and that will lead to a political resolution to allow the country to move forward. But whoever is in power in 2017 and beyond is going to face an economy that is destroyed and is going to be faced with a need and a deeply polarized country. So whoever is going to be the next president of Venezuela is going to be faced with a really, really tough task. Hopefully, that person, whoever he or she is, will be able to bring in the international community to assist that recovery, which is going to be long and it is going to be painful.
Well, on that rather pessimistic note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Eric Farnsworth, he's Vice President of the America Society and the Council of the Americas, and Eric Olson, Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Gentlemen, gracias. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
De nada.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Audrius Rigas. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.